This week on Making Contact.
What kind of world do we want for our kids, for ourselves? This administrator at the hospital should make $600,000 a year, and a woman who's worked there for 30 years should worry that she's not going to be able to pay her electric bill when she retires? What the hell kind of world do we want to live in?
Multi-million dollar union-busting campaigns, heavy-handed responses from law enforcement officials, and shifts in labor law make union organizing a tough prospect these days. But despite the hurdles, there have been key victories. On this special edition from the Labor Desk of the National Radio Project, we take a look at successful efforts by hospital workers in Bronxville, New York, meatpackers in Omaha, Nebraska, and dock workers in Charleston, South Carolina. What challenges did organizers overcome, and what are some of the lessons learned? I'm Philip Babich, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. Housekeepers, dietary workers, nurse aides, clerks, and other service employees at Lawrence Hospital in Bronxville, New York, landed a hard-won union contract on April 9, 2003. The struggle began nearly 30 years ago when the Hospital Workers Union, Local 1199, organized at nonprofit hospitals throughout New York City. The strike fell short of a full victory, but there were changes in labor laws that gave hospital workers in New York City and outlying areas collective bargaining rights. This included Lawrence Hospital. Administrators there promised to negotiate a contract, but that never happened. More than 30 years later, a group of workers revived the effort to organize at the hospital, and after a contentious struggle that lasted 3 years, they finally got a union contract. From Bronxville, New York, Jeff Brady has more.
Hospital Workers Union Local 1199 had started out as a union of pharmacists and other drugstore workers in New York City in the early 1930s. By the time the union started organizing at Lawrence Hospital, 1199 had already organized the rank and file of workers at New York City's voluntary hospitals. These workers were mostly African American and Puerto Rican, and the majority of them, women. Marion Beavers had worked at Lawrence Hospital since 1965, when organizing efforts were just getting underway. She was 18 at the time, and within a couple months, she was on strike.
When I started working, they didn't have a union. We didn't have anything. We didn't have any benefits. There was no buses during the weekend. You had to walk to work over here. So at some point in time, someone came to us and asked us, what about unionize? So we all decided that we was going to go out on strike. So we decided that in March that we would strike. And all the employees walked down in the main lobby. It was a lot of people, everybody. Housekeeping, kitchen, laundry, everybody walked out.
For the next 55 days, service workers conducted mass demonstrations and daily picket lines around the hospital, demanding that the administrators recognize the union. It was 1965, and civil rights leaders such as Ruby Dee and Martin Luther King Jr. came to lend their support to the strike. Community support also came from students at a nearby college. But daily conditions in the bitter cold of January 1965 took its toll on some picketers, including Marion Beavers.
I had got sick because it was out in the wintertime, and it was like the nurses were so mean to us at that time. We used to walk around in that circle, and back then they had nurses living over there. And they used to throw water out on us. And one time the water hit me and I got pneumonia. So I was at home sick for a long time. My sister would come and walk in my spot for me.
To end the strike, hospital administrators promised to negotiate with Local 1199. But they stalled and later targeted the union activists and workers for dismissal. Lawrence Hospital workers eventually received benefits, but not a union contract. More than 30 years went by before workers began to organize once more. Jay Adams is a phlebotomist, someone who draws blood, and was a lead organizer at Lawrence Hospital during their union contract struggle.
When I started working here in 1983, okay, it wasn't that necessary to cry out for a union here, okay? But of course, as the 80s turned into the 90s, and everything went downhill everywhere, the need for us to do something here, you know, just to save ourselves, much less, you know, help ourselves, that became paramount. We were just trying to form a union to take care of ourselves. All of a sudden, we find out we're part of a 30-plus year thing that was tied into the civil rights problems of the 1960s.
The struggle at Lawrence Hospital reignited in the fall of 2000. By this time, the number of sick days for service workers was cut in half. Job security was a key issue, and workers went 3 years without a raise. Many of them had to pay for some of their health insurance. It was clear wages and worker benefits had not reflected the dramatic change in the cost of living during the last 30 years. Critics and union activists said administrators ran the hospital with a plantation mindset. Lawrence Hospital stood alone in the new millennium as maybe the only voluntary hospital in Westchester County without a union contract. According to Jay Adams, the biggest hurdle was getting workers to unite amid vicious union-busting strategies. He says the hospital used everything to keep the workers from organizing. They spent maybe hundreds of thousands to hire an anti-union firm from Kentucky. Professional meetings were arranged to derail organizing efforts, and workers were forced to watch anti-union films.
There were workers that were literally petrified to even stand on the same floor with us, much less stand next to us, because of fear of losing their job, because of what was told to them. We had one food service worker here. She's been here a couple years longer than I have. They told her in a very threatening way that if the union was to come in and win here and have a contract and everything, she would no longer be able to bring her son in here for health care.
Once the climate was right, the hospital's union, 1199, sent in Jackie Aileen to get a contract for Lawrence Hospital workers. Community help also arrived from local colleges and churches such as Sarah Lawrence College and the West Center Church. Priscilla Marolo teaches American history and directs the master's program in women's history at Sarah Lawrence College.
It's hard often for low-wage workers to organize, to get it going. Not to win so much, it's just to get it going, because there's not a lot of savings, there's not a lot of resources, and so people have to think twice. You know, you really have to think, well, what would happen if I lost this job, right? And I think that what happened at Lawrence is that once people got active, they had been so kicked around by that hospital for so long that there was no turning them back.
Jackie Aileen was persistent in her organizing. She parked herself in the hospital's public cafeteria and began talking to workers during their breaks. And over time, she found that workers would confide in her.
I got to know them one-on-one. After seeing me for a couple weeks, couple months, they started coming over and speaking to me. We kind of built a relationship. They would see me like 7 in the morning, 8 at night. Some of them would say to me, you know, once they started seeing me all the time, they were like, why are you always here?
In March 2001, Local 1199 narrowly lost a vote among Lawrence's service workers. The total was 124 to 119, with about a dozen contested votes. Between the summer of 2002 and into the spring of 2003, Lawrence administrators fought hard to stall negotiation efforts toward a union contract. Local 1199 unionists countered with newspaper ads to expose alleged mismanagement at the hospital and mobilizing its efforts at other hospitals to support the Lawrence workers. By the end of the spring, a tentative agreement was reached with Lawrence Hospital, and later they got a 5-year agreement, which included wage increases and a free health care plan. But the final tally at the last election to unionize was a dramatic moment, says Aileen.
They fought us till the last day, and it was just so amazing to me. This just stands out with me probably forever, was to see the vote being counted. One side was supporters and the other side was against us, and basically it was in our favor and it was going in the count, and we were all nervous. We were holding hands, we were praying. And then when we won the vote, we just jumped. Some of us cried because it took my whole summer. It took my energy, my life. You know, I had to separate from my children for a little while. We were so happy that night to see that we finally, after 35, 38 years, that we won 1199 in Lawrence.
Lawrence service workers ratified the union contract April 9th, 2003. Meanwhile, as Jay Adams roams the hospital halls, it's obvious he is the go-to man for worker comments and grievances.
Hey, Rich. Don't worry, we're taking care of it tomorrow.
He says there's a vigilance among union workers at Lawrence to hold on to what's been accomplished.
There are still elements here that are not satisfied with what we've achieved, and they are going to do everything they can to try to destroy that.
The 5-year contract will be renegotiated in its 5th year. For Making Contact, I'm Jeff Brady in Bronxville, New York.
We'll have more on union organizing in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information about the subject of this week's program, or you'd like to contact any of our guests, please give us a call. It's toll-free, 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. Many labor organizers and experts see the collective bargaining power of unions as the key to improving safety conditions at meatpacking plants. Immigrants are becoming the predominant workforce in such facilities, and efforts to organize are facing new challenges, as was the case at a plant in Omaha, Nebraska. Correspondent Hope Stockwell has more.
Efforts to organize the Northern States beef plant in South Omaha began 3 years ago.
United Food and Commercial Workers every year picks 2 or 3 different locations throughout the country, and they have what they call Union Summer, where they'll bring, they hire actually, college kids, and they call it a Union Summer program where they train them on how to organize.
Donna McDonald, president of United Food and Commercial Workers, Local 271.
July and August of 2000 was Union Summer for Omaha. They targeted the packing houses because we have so many packing houses here that weren't organized. That's how it began. And then OTOC came on board, I want to say late August, beginning of September, because we found that with the Hispanic workforce that currently are in all of our packing houses, they're an extremely religious group. And we thought that by bringing in the churches, and that's what OTOC is, Omaha Together One Community, is a faith-based group. There's 46 or 47 different churches that belong to that. When we organize, we do a lot of home calling. And that's a lot of individual, one-on-one attention. But in the churches, and if they give a message in their masses, it takes that word even further. And it also gives them the support to know that their churches are behind in them voicing their, having a voice in their workplace as well as in the community. They know there's a lot of advantages to being unionized, higher wages, better benefits. And if they have higher wages, better benefits, then they're a better community participant.
Organizers met stiff resistance from the parent company of Northern States Beef, ConAgra, which no longer is the controlling interest of the facility. The maintenance workers at the plant had won a union contract, but according to Tom Holler, lead organizer for Omaha Together One Community, ConAgra intimidated other sectors of the workforce prior to a union election in November of 2000.
The production workers, which is the vast majority of the workers at the plant, lost that election. And they lost that election because on the Wednesday before the vote, one of the vice presidents from ConAgra came over and they stopped production. And he made many, many promises to those workers about how things would improve and asked them to not vote for the union. There were other problems with the way ConAgra conducted itself. They filmed workers as they were signing, you know, recruiting other people to support the union at the gate, which is a violation of the laws of the United States of America.
So organizers started over. Marcela Cervantes, a Mexican immigrant, was among those recruited by OTOC to help out. She had worked in 3 packing plants in the area and knew the dangers of sharp knives and fast production lines.
I can tell you a lot of stories, you know, workers who lost their fingers or they get very big injuries in their hands or in their back, also on their shoulders. The most injury that almost all workers who work more than 6 months in that kind of places, you get carpal tunnels, arthritis, and I get arthritis in my hands.
Cervantes says despite the harsh working conditions, employees still balked at having a union, which could address speed of production lines and work safety issues. They were afraid of retribution.
The majority of workers of those in those plants are immigrants, like me, you know. A lot of them, they left their families in Mexico, and they have to support their families there, and they have to work hard to support their living here. So they really afraid to lose their job.
Donna McDonald says she assured workers they had the right to organize under Nebraska's Meatpackers Bill of Rights, and another union election was scheduled in May of 2002.
Maintenance guys won their election, and then once the production people saw that how a union works, you go in, you represent, they have a voice, things changed dramatically for them. It wasn't who you were or the color of your skin or how much brown nosing you did. It's everything was done by seniority.
They had a very successful campaign, and it was really the highlight of it was a week prior to the election.
Tom Holler of OTOC.
A large gathering at St. Agnes Church where many, many of the workers from ConAgra participated in a liturgy there and committed themselves one to another to support the union. And the vote a week later was by a 2-1 margin for the union. In many instances, when there is a union organizing drive and there is a victory in the election, it takes forever, and sometimes they never reach the point where they actually are willing to negotiate a contract. That was not the case at ConAgra.
The contract negotiations, the major hurdle with them was the language barrier.
Donna McDonald of UFCW.
We had to have everything translated as we were saying it. And during negotiations, you get a rhythm going. We couldn't quite get that rhythm going until it was pretty much a third of the way to half of the way into the negotiations before we worked out a system where they all wore headsets and it was being translated as we were saying it rather than stop, start, so that we can maintain the rhythm.
McDonald adds that they worked hard to keep insurance benefits.
The company wanted to have them pay 25% of the premium, which they're doing in a lot of locations, but we maintained 3 and 14, $3 a week for single coverage, $14 a week for family coverage, which is great in the industry if you look at it.
The contract also included a 65-cent per hour raise over a 2-year period and increased the starting wage from $9 an hour to $9.65. A process for filing grievances was established, as was a safety committee, and the company pledged $10,000 a year to a multicultural fund, which currently is being used to teach workers English.
I think there has been a significant increase in hope among the leadership in the community about the possibility of addressing problems that seemed overwhelming and impossible to deal with. So that is probably the most important thing, change that's happened overall.
Both OTOC and UFCW Local 271 say they'll continue efforts to organize employees at a half dozen other meatpacking plants in the Omaha area. Already, workers at two other packing houses have been inspired by Northern States to organize. For Making Contact, I'm Hope Stockwell in Omaha, Nebraska.
On the sidewalk in front of the Union Hall, there are white crime scene outlines of two dead men. It's a way to keep the spirit of the San Francisco waterfront strike of 1934 alive for the workers who enter the hall and the passers-by who happen across the figures with their names written beside them, Howard Sperry and Nicholas Bordois. A ring of words around the sidewalk memorial states, July 5th, 1934, police murder, men killed, shot in back, killed during SF Maritime General Strike. It was the bloody beginning of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union.
Yeah, Pee-wee.
Yeah.
You got a 6 p.m. let go at Sealand.
Okay.
And George Bell is your lead man.
Okay, 6 p.m. to be
let go.
Okay.
Sealand.
Okay.
All right.
Inside the hall, a massive dome structure that takes up the better part of a block, Lawrence Tebow is making job assignments to dock workers. A ship is leaving at 6 p.m., Four workers are needed, two in the front and two in the back, to perform a let-go. That's when they untie the ship from the dock. Tebow is reading down a list of ILWU Local 10 workers who are eligible for a job.
At Sealand, George Bell is the lead man, and there's the Horizon Pacific.
It's a far cry from the way jobs used to be doled out on the waterfront. Before the historic 1934 strike, a boss did the hiring, and workers had to pay kickbacks just for the privilege of being selected. Grumbling among the dock workers attracted a union representative to try and negotiate a contract, but what they got was a yellow dog contract, an agreement that in exchange for work, they wouldn't join a union. The dock workers rejected the contract and went on strike.
And the National Guards came out and killed some of our members, shot them in the back for protesting the working conditions on the waterfront. And because of that, we have a holiday called Bloody Thursday. And every July 5th, we do not work on the waterfront. And we celebrate their death because of their death, we were able to get a hiring hall. We were able to get the 8-hour day. And a lot of things that were causing the problems were adjusted based on the 34 strike.
A long-standing saying among union workers is, an injury to one is an injury to all. That's exactly how Lawrence Tebow concluded his letter of support to dock workers in Charleston, South Carolina, in early 2000 when he was president of ILWU Local 10. At issue was a work stoppage that turned violent on January 20th of that year, an event that would result in the indictment of four black members of the International Longshoremen's Association, Local 1422, and one white member of the ILA, Local 1771, later to be known as the Charleston Five.
We saw it on the internet the next day, and I called the president there, Ken Riley, and he informed me as to what happened. I made a report to our membership, our executive board, our international office, and got the ball rolling in terms of getting support for the Charleston Five.
Tebow went to Charleston. The intense police presence, tear gas, guns, dogs, SWAT teams, was eerily similar to the 1934 Maritime General Strike in San Francisco. Ken Riley, president of the ILA Local 1422, says there were about 600 heavily armed police and state troopers on the docks in Charleston that January day.
By God, it was something like I had never experienced in my life. We witnessed the prison buses coming in. We witnessed armored personnel carriers going down to the site, buses coming in with troopers, motorcycles, helicopters. Guys calling us from the docks saying that they got a lot of police boats in the water. What's this all about? What's getting ready to happen? I felt right then that we were being set up, someone was overreacting, and they wanted to really put this group of workers in their place. And, you know, this may be fine for other areas, but it's definitely not going to be tolerated in the state of South Carolina.
South Carolina is one of the most anti-union states in the country. It's what's known as a right-to-work state, meaning that non-union employees get the same benefits in a workplace as union members. Since employees who are affiliated with the union pay dues and make the effort to fight for higher wages and benefits, right-to-work laws, say trade unionists, have the effect of keeping the workforce divided, thereby undermining organizing drives. The ILA locals had been peacefully protesting since the fall of 1999, picketing the Danish shipping company Nordana, which had started to use non-union workers to load and unload cargo. In defending the arrested ILA members, the union subpoenaed videotape and documents in an attempt to show that law enforcement authorities were prepped to crack down violently on the dock workers.
And we saw a film where they were being told that this was going to be a battle down in the streets of Charleston tonight, where there had never been a battle before. So are you saying that you're going to instigate a battle? So these guys were fired up, and they had was issuing their shields and their helmets like they was like they're getting ready for a war. And they exemplified that when they got down there that night. They started beating on their shields with their clubs, saying, bring it on, niggas, we're going to bust your head tonight. And this stuff was provoking. And as the guys tried to get to where the permit allowed them to be, they started poking them with the sticks and started swinging, and that's how the fight broke out.
Riley took a blow to the head.
The presidents of the three locals stayed behind, and then we got a call within 10 minutes that something had already happened, and, you know, we ran, you know, all the way down there and actually just went right to the front of the line and was breaking up the fights and had gotten it all calmed. And then, unprovoked, an officer came running out of the formation. As I turned around, he clubbed me right beside the head. And there are bright lights shining, these construction lights that they had, you know, on the side. And naturally, when I took my cap off, the blood just poured all over my face and I couldn't even see. And the guys, two of my guys grabbed me by the arm and was walking me out of there. And one took off their shirt and put over the wound in my forehead. By the time it was over, 9 of our guys had been arrested, had been in the prison bus, including my brother.
The charges were dropped against 4 of them. The remaining 5 were indicted on felony rioting and conspiracy to riot charges and faced 5 to 10 years in prison. Riley says that solidarity, nationally and internationally, was instrumental in fighting the charges. Spanish dock workers boarded an Ordena ship that had been loaded by non-union workers in Charleston. Members of the Coordinadero Union demanded that the company settle with the ILA or face work stoppages in a Spanish port.
That's when we got the call from Ordena that they wanted to sit down and talk, and they came to the union hall. It was not between Ordena and the employers and the ports authorities as is customary. For the first time, we had negotiations directly with the line. A local union had negotiations directly with the line in our union hall, and there we sat for 2 days until we hammered out an agreement.
The ILWU's Lawrence Thibault is modest about his union's efforts to generate international solidarity for the Charleston Five.
All I know is we did what we had to do, and hopefully it had an impact of letting the, at least most people know that the labor movement was not dead.
What I learned is that without worker-to-worker connection, not only in this country but worldwide, and workers supporting workers, we have no future. We have to build worker-to-worker connections and to build solidarity around the world because of this global agenda that we all are facing. This was about globalization. This was about the multinationals supporting one steamship line to break down the only strong union in South Carolina. And the only way we won that struggle was not that our politicians did it for us, not that we had the laws on our side, but we had the solidarity of workers willing to stand up to support other workers.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact, produced by the Labor Desk of the National Radio Project. A look at union organizing, challenges, and lessons learned. Thanks for listening. If you would like more information about the subject of this week's program, or if you would like to get in touch with any of our guests, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. Making Contact is an independent production. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you have suggestions for future programs, we'd love to hear from you. Lisa Rubman is our executive director, Peggy Law, founding director, associate producer Amy Pomerlow, office manager Rosalind Fay, associate manager Susanna Hines, our intern is Lindsay Goldsmith, senior advisor Norman Solomon, national advisor David Barsamian, and I'm managing producer Philip Babich. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Until next time.